I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. C.E. Gautier is a writer and theater maker in Vancouver, known for his acclaimed plays Falling in Time, Broken, Motifs and Repetitions, Claire, and People Like Vince. These are works that have been staged nationally and internationally and on radio and television. He has just published a new memoir, Double Melancholy, Art, Beauty, and the Making of a Brown Queer Man. It's a fascinating book that looks at his childhood in Vancouver, the people around him, and the works of music and literature that have shaped him, and not just intellectually, but emotionally. The book is a memoir that has portions of his journal entries, some from childhood, and while he offers often scathing critiques of himself, the book serves as a commentary on those works. Anne of Green Gables, A Room with a View, A Streetcar Named Desire, Death in Venice, Queer as Folk, the writings of Camille Paglia and Susan Sontag, and the music of Maria Callas that were largely heteronormative and white. These were works that had the effect of invisibilizing him as a queer person of color. He also takes on the culture itself with discussions of art and the discourse, not to mention colonization. There's a lot in this book and a lot worth pondering. I'll get the author who joins me now to talk about this book and more. C.E. Gautier is a two-time finalist of the Lambda Literary Award and the 2013 recipient of the Dane Ogilvy Prize. He is the former artistic producer of the Frank Theatre Company, receiving two Jesse Awards for his work as a theatre artist and producer. He has been writer-in-residence at Burton House Writers' Retreat and Kogawa House, and playwright-in-residence at the Fire Hall Art Center and the Vancouver Playhouse. His website is at cegatchelian.com. This book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. There will be two events in Vancouver, 7 p.m., the 30th of May, at Pump Jack Pub, 1167 Davie Street, and Wednesday, the 24th of July, at the Vancouver Public Library's Central Branch, 7 p.m., a reading with Aaron Chan, the author of the memoir, This City is a Minefield. Please welcome to the Planta on Line program, C.E. Gautier. Mr. Gautier, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Joseph?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm good. I'm very good. I'm a little jet-lagged, but all good.
So. May I call you Chris?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even when I'm reading your book, Double Melancholy, even at a young age, you seem like a snob. And... And I know that seems harsh for people listening to this, but I think if one reads the book, you'll find out, you know, how that's worked out. But but I'm wondering, that sort of attitude that you had towards other people around you, people that you'd encounter, say, in the sort, was that a response to being different to those people who probably made you feel unwelcome, say?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably, I would say that's accurate, because I think people will often behave badly as a result of some kind of hurt, right? I see this all the time in people I interact with, and it's something that, you know, as I move around the world, and you know, sometimes I notice people treating me not necessarily in the best possible way. I think I kind of step back a little and realize that it's probably coming from some place of hurt, that they've been wounded in some way in their past. And was I a snob? Yeah. I think that's completely accurate. I was definitely a snob, even as a young kid.
And it
was a result of being wounded. I don't think I necessarily was conscious, totally conscious of that, or I wanted to block that out. But it was my way of compensating. Yeah.
And then the and I don't mean to give anything away, but I mean, as one gets older, as one does, I think they realize just what happens with other people, and then you become more, you recognize what's happened to other people and why they do the things that they do, right?
Yeah, you do. You become, as you get older, you develop more empathy,
right?
You know, for human beings, and I mean, I'd like to think that I've become, through the school of hard knocks, become more compassionate and empathetic as I've gotten older. I think I have. I mean, things don't upset me now. I know that things don't upset me now nearly as much as they used to.
Yeah.
What's
it like then for you to, because there are portions of your journal that are throughout the book. When you read some of that early stuff, especially when you were a kid, to read that again, I mean, there are obviously various thoughts that are in your head as you're reading it again years later. But to share that and to have a dialogue with that person, say, what's that like?
You know, it's, I've been asked about these diary entries, because for a number of people who've read the book, they actually think that those diary entries were in some ways the most enjoyable parts of the book. They're certainly the most revealing,
mm-hmm.
right? And some people, you know, have asked me, you know, did you actually have any second thoughts about including those diary entries in your book?
Mm-hmm.
Because if that were me, I don't know if I could, because they don't show you in a very good light. And, you know, for me, it wasn't actually, it wasn't that difficult a decision. One of the things that I was very, very clear about from the beginning of the writing of this book was I didn't want to present a triumph narrative. I wanted to show it all, like my warts, everything, because I wanted to reveal in the book how the political informs the personal.
Yeah.
You know, and how. You know, the prejudices, the bigotries, the inequities in society are reflected in the way, certainly in the way I move, the way that I have moved through the world. Those diary entries, I think, certainly reveal exactly that I was very much, I was deeply colonized and deeply... deeply informed by, even though I wasn't, you know, really conscious of it, I was quite informed by, I was really deeply informed and imprinted by the bigotries in the larger society. For me, it would not have been an authentic piece of writing if I didn't include these diary entries, if I didn't, as I say, if I didn't show off all my warts and all my flaws, all my shortcomings. I think it was a non-negotiable.
So in some of the journal entries, even at a very young age, you come off as gifted. A genius of sorts. Where does that come from? Because I mean, I doubt that they simply come from these works of art or artists that you found inspiration from.
Yeah, where did that come from? I think both of my parents are quite intelligent. They're both very articulate. My dad has never had. I think my musical gift certainly came from my dad. My dad, never took formal music lessons, but taught himself how to play a number of instruments on his own, right? So, I think I got my musical gifts from my dad. For both of my parents, I think I got my love of language.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, I don't really know where it came from. I mean, it's kind of I just know all I can tell you is that from a very young age, I was very artistically inclined.
Yeah.
I was writing stories from the age of six, and my teachers were pretty encouraging of my writing from a very, very early age. It was something that I really felt I had a knack. I had a gift for.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something I enjoyed doing. I think that inclination towards art, and in particular books, was intensified by, knowing that I was different.
Yeah.
I can't say that I knew I was queer from the get-go, but I knew I was different. I knew in some way that I was different in some way that I couldn't articulate. I knew that I didn't fit in on a number of fronts. As it so often is, as we've talked about already, it's about overcompensation. So the emptiness that I felt as a result of not fitting in with my schoolmates, the other kids in school, kids in class, that emptiness I tried to fill with books, primarily books,
yeah.
And music as well, because I was musically inclined as well. So
yeah.
those books and music really, they were my salvation.
Right.
As a child, they really were. They kind of saved my life.
They
made my childhood less intolerable.
Yeah.
I actually don't know how I could have survived without those things.
Yeah,
because I was so alienated. So, yeah.
That's the other thing that struck me, because we're about the same age, and
yeah.
The experience that you had of say a teacher pressing a book into your hand, saying that maybe you should read this, or the way you access certain movies, certain shows, certain music,
yeah.
it's a very different experience than say a kid growing up today, in
mm-hmm.
terms of,
mm-hmm.
of experiencing the things of art that you did.
Right.
It was a real tactile form, I guess, when you would say read the book, or
mm-hmm.
There wasn't a YouTube where you could watch, film clips or concert clips and the sort, right?
No, it wasn't at your fingertips the way it is now.
Yeah.
In terms of TV, I guess, wasn't at your fingertips, but certainly books. Books were at the time, and they were like a physical object. It was like another, literally another, like being.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It was another being, and so this interface with it, with this other physical object. I think that intensified the exchange. Right, and I'm not saying that can't happen now, but it was just different.
Yeah,
there were less alternatives then.
Sure,
there were less options, right, than there are now.
Less distractions, right?
Yeah, the more distractions now.
Yeah.
Fewer distractions then, for sure.
Yeah. You touched on colonization, and I think this is important because the book is called Double Melancholy, and we'll talk about being queer in a moment, but
mm-hmm.
The part that I related to, obviously, is because my parents are Filipino as well.
Yeah.
This is something that I don't think I really thought about. And you talk about it very intensely in the book, and it gives one just an incredible amount of food for thought in terms of how we are shaped by how others view us.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I... you felt it quite intently growing up. I mean, this sounds like an AA meeting. I'm just sharing my own experience. I didn't think about it that much, and I don't know if that means that it wasn't a problem for me. Was it because I say found my own place, maybe?
You talk about being Filipinx, and all that, you know. It's not something I necessarily thought of a lot myself either, right? It was only, it's only been in the last 10 years where, I've been evolving politically and becoming more, quote-unquote woke in my race politics.
Sure.
But a lot of the things that didn't make sense to me growing up suddenly started making sense. Just to take one example, I mean, personally, I'm only talking about myself. I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
I can't speak for anyone else. But I've tended to really defer to white people all my life. I mean, I've really, just looking back at figures in my life. Who have held power, and they tended to be white, because that's society we live in. I think there are many occasions where I could have challenged them, and I didn't, and I should have, one of the things in the writing of the book that I link that to is the history of colonization
mm-hmm.
that Filipinx people have experienced for centuries now, for like 500, 600 years. And the imprint of that, and how that's at least some of that must be in our DNA, right? It might be a controversial thesis, but I think it's worth musing on.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, I've the recent guests I've had on the show have talked about the Aboriginal experience, is that a lot of this trauma carries down 2, 3, 4 generations down the line.
Yeah.
Whether or not, one has been, say, in a residential school. The trauma of their ancestors, say, that carries, and you mentioned that in the book about you carrying that from, your family, say.
Yeah, and again, in the book, I've just barely scratched the surface of it, and I think it's something that maybe demands another book for me to really go deep into it. I think it is another book, right?
Yeah.
It's a complex, intricate issue that requires a lot of delving, a lot of, that's beyond the scope of this particular book, I think.
And people do find it difficult to talk about, don't they? I mean, the minute someone brings that up, someone, feels threatened by that almost.
Well, there's just so much that you need to contend with, There's, your audiences are made up of, all sorts of different people, from people of different races, I know that a significant portion of the audience for this book will be of European origins, and there's white fragility that one needs to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
Race issues of race and colonization are explosive, you know. Even among Filipinx, there are Filipinx people who, you know, just don't, it's too painful.
Right.
It's too painful for them. They don't want to delve into this. But as a writer, that's never, you know, difficult issues are difficult issues, difficult subjects, difficult truths have never been things I've been necessarily afraid to tackle. And I actually think, you know, I would be doing a disservice to, you know, to my practice as a writer if I didn't lean into those difficult issues.
Right? Yeah. And one realizes, as one reads the book, Double Melancholy, that the work of decolonization, I mean, that's very important for you. And it's an ongoing thing, right? It's not something that ends as you finish this book, right?
Oh, no, definitely not. And again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about how I didn't, I deliberately set out not to write a triumph narrative. I wanted readers to see that this is an ongoing process. I mean, this book really is just the beginning of my decolonization process. The book is concretely about my experience.
Yeah.
I'm not speaking for other, Filipinx individuals or queer Filipinx individuals or other queer people of color, queer men of color. This is about me. It's very, very specific to my experience. I've been really heartened to see in the last couple of weeks that I've been touring this book, launching this book on the East Coast in Toronto, Montreal, and New York, that a lot of people who have read the book or who have heard, who have heard me read from the book, they're finding the book relevant.
Yeah.
I mean, even though the book is very specific to me, somehow the specificity of the book has, in a paradoxical way, it's opened up space for the reader to insert the specificities of their own stories.
Yeah.
Right? It's allowed them to delve into the specificities of their own trajectory. So that's been great to hear. That's been great to hear.
Yeah. There's a part in the book where you're talking to a friend, and you're telling them that you haven't been as knowledgeable about your culture, your heritage, if you will, as you'd like. And I think you said that you thought that it was, the school system or society's lack of, focus on that Philippine history that you lamented. And then your friend said that, that's one's own responsibility. What have you done, you gave the figure a moment ago about 10 years, the last 10 years, in terms of filling in sort of the gaps of your knowledge?
Yeah, well, it's, still a long ways to go, but, I started off with, I think a lot of people in my position, namely people who are also Filipinx and very colonized and raised in the West, start off, which is, I started reading Jose Rizal.
Uh-huh.
Because that was one name that I heard growing up. That was one of the few historical Filipinx figures whose name I did hear growing up from my parents. I've read his two novels. I'm less interested in history than I am in art. I mean, art is my thing. So I've been reading a lot of Filipinx, North American Filipinx writers, you know, like Jessica Hagedorn,
right,
who's a Filipinx American novelist. You know, I've been reading her and learning a lot from her. And following the stuff that's been happening in the Philippines,
yeah,
recently. I mean, that, you know, I mean, that's a complex thing, and I don't want to, that'll take long, that, you know, I don't want to spill over our time allotment, but that's messy, what's,
wow,
happening in the Philippines. It's extremely messy. My feelings about it are extremely complex, and, but needless to say, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
it really is heartbreaking.
And I just wanted to touch on one thing about that, because
yeah,
you write in the book about Duterte, and a lot of us have feelings about him that aren't probably positive.
Mm-hmm.
But you write something that I found very thoughtful, in that, mm-hmm, you understand where he's coming from.
I do, yeah. I mean, it's rage. It's, you know, in a nutshell, we'll put aside, yes, the horrible things that he's
said and done, right?
He has said and done. But I understand where that rage is coming from. And in the book, I say it's the result of centuries,
mm-hmm,
of being brutalized and colonized, and being robbed of your identity. And I have to tell you the truth. I mean, when Duterte first came on the scene, you know, I didn't know anything about him, really. You know, here living in the west coast of Canada in relative privilege, you know, with only a relatively scant knowledge of the political landscape in the Philippines, I didn't know much about him. But I liked his chutzpah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way. I liked the fact that he was not afraid to take on the West.
Mm.
There was something invigorating about it, this refusal to be bullied.
Yeah.
You know. So on just that level, it was being confronted by him was a positive experience.
Yeah.
You know. But I think that's indicative of just how, I mean, the fact that that alone was a positive experience, I think is indicative of how, as Filipinx people, I won't generalize, I'll talk about myself, as a Filipinx person, it's indicative of how much I've been missing,
right,
how much I lack in terms of any discernible sense of self-worth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I want to touch on the vernacular. I mean, you've used this term Filipinx, and
mm-hmm,
that's something that's coming into the fore a lot.
Yeah.
How do you explain that to people? I mean, does everyone have to use it who's Filipino, say?
No, I don't think. I mean, I think it's a personal journey. It's a personal decision that every Filipino or Filipinx-identifying person needs to make for themselves. Filipinx, it is a fairly recent term, and I've only fairly recently started using it. It's essentially a decolonizing gesture,
mm,
because Tagalog, which is the main, primary Filipinx dialect,
mm-hmm,
was originally a non-gendered language, and the Spaniards, when they colonized the Philippines in the 16th century, brought gender to the language.
Mm.
And so people are more accustomed to, you know, people are more accustomed, more familiar with the terms Filipino, Filipina. But that's a remnant of this genderedness that the Spanish brought to the language. So I've chosen not to to engage with that anymore, and so therefore I've chosen to identify myself as Filipinx.
Yeah.
Again, as I mentioned, a challenge to colonization. So.
Yeah. The other thing that you write about in the book is you use the word queer rather than gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a fascinating part of the book in terms of because the word gay is something that I think a lot of us use. And there is a distinction there for you especially, right?
There is. And, and I do still, in casual conversations with friends, I'll refer to myself as gay often. But I do identify more profoundly with the term queer, because queer for me is it denotes more than who I, you know, happen to have sex with or how I have sex. It encompasses a political dimension, as well. I feel that I'm, I'm fairly non-conforming in basically every area of my life, and especially and including in my political and social views, So that's why, I prefer the term queer. It's a much more all-encompassing, much richer term.
Yeah, in one of your journal entries, you write about a conversation you have with someone, and they're telling you that you have no substance. And then they say that explains a craving that you need to be filled. The person criticizing you, were they talking about sex?
Yeah. So that was an actual email I got from somebody that I had been intimate with, who I had a falling out with. Yeah. So the linear meaning of it was sexual, right? I think he was also, I mean, I don't know how smart he was, but at least I picked up on the broader implications of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's why that, I guess, I mean, he knew how to hurt me, because he really hurt me. He really hurt me with that email. He was ostensibly just talking about our sexual relationship, but he actually, it hit a nerve with me, because I think, it revealed something about my own sense of emptiness. My own sense of emptiness that as I'm talking about in the book, I've been struggling with my whole life. So.
Yeah, that's an aspect of the book that as you mentioned a moment ago, it's something specific in your life, but it took on greater meaning, and I obviously got something more out of it from reading that, and it made me understand the book a little bit more in terms of what you were trying to unpack about yourself.
Well, you're a very close reader. I really appreciate it. So, yeah.
There's a lot of sex in the book, and I know I sound like a prude, but I mean, what sort of reaction have you been getting from readers, say, about what you write about so candidly and so openly?
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, I mean, the book has just been, you know, it was just published a few weeks ago, so I haven't gotten a lot of feedback yet. I mean, so far, nobody has openly complained or even talked to me really about the sex in the book. I'm sure that will probably happen as more and more people read the book. Again, for me, it was, as a queer man, sex is, make a long story short, is a key part of our lives and how we come into ourselves as individuals, right? And again, it just goes back to what I was saying earlier about really getting into the nitty gritty, uncomfortable details of my personal life and how the political often, or almost always, informed in some way how I moved around the world as a person in my daily life. And
The one thing that I was wondering about, Chris, was because you write in the book that you were a late bloomer, if you will, and mm-hmm. Your understanding of what sex meant in your life, did that have an effect on how you are or you became more artistic, say, in terms of understanding how you created art and the success that you've had, say, as a playwright? That's obviously had to have a connection, did it?
In terms of how my sex life affected my...
Well, not your sex life, but in terms of how you discovered sex and what that effect had in your life. I'm wondering, is there a connection to say, your development as an artist?
The work that I was reading and how it...
No, I was thinking of the work that you've created in terms of the plays that you've written and the sort.
Okay, the work that I've created, the plays that I've written and all that, and how they were informed by my sexuality, is that what you're saying?
Sure, yeah, because I've read the book, it seems that there is a connection, and I'm just wondering if there was.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, you're right what you know, and certainly as when I was younger, definitely, in terms of my playwriting, sex played a pretty big role in what I wrote. I was also, when I was younger, I was more obsessed, more fixated on sex than I probably am now, right? Because, what do 20-year-olds think about? what do 20-year-olds obsess about?
Hardly anything else, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was no different. So, so inevitably that was reflected in the plays I was writing at the time, for sure. But also, I mean, it's still something I like. It's still something that for me is important to write about, because I don't think we live in a sex-positive society. I think, in my experience, I think a lot of people still have tons of hang-ups about sex and sexuality.
Yeah.
Again, it comes back to my unwillingness to shy away from writing about physical truth, right?
So,
there's no more intimate act than sex. And I think a lot of the messiness of life and how the political intersects with the personal are crystallized in the sexual act. So for that reason, I may not be as obsessed about sex now as I was you know, in my when I was younger, but I'm still writing about it. I continue to write about it.
So. One of the things that I don't know if take exception to is the right word, but one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot since I finished the book is you talk about art and the distinction that some people might have between high art versus low art.
Yeah.
And you cite as an example that one can't probably look at an episode of Full House and compare that to Hamlet, say.
Mm-hmm.
As I've gotten older in terms of my conception of what I think is art, whether I like it or not, is that it all comes from, I don't know, the same place, if you will, in terms of the artistic process, and whether we like it or not doesn't matter. I mean, it just is art. I mean, are you, did you still have the distinction between high versus low art, or is that somewhat?
You know, it's a tough one. I think, I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I think, because, I mean, these things are always, these things are fluid, and they're historically, they are historically based, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like Shakespeare, certainly if you look at how Shakespeare was performed back when, back when it was originally performed, I mean, it was entertainment for the masses,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I actually don't have an answer. I don't have an answer for that right now. I don't know if you can get back to me about it. Tomorrow. But
it could be the subject of another book, perhaps, right?
Yeah. It's a tough one. No, that's a tough one. I mean, that's a really good question. I still make those distinctions, but, like, for example, I think there is a difference between classical music and popular music, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe that there is good classical music and bad classical music,
right?
And there is, there is excellent pop music and not so excellent pop music, right? So I think you can find excellence in all different types of places. All different types of artistic places, right? I don't think excellence is the exclusive domain of quote unquote high art, right? I think you can find excellence in pop art as well, right?
Yeah.
You can find excellence in graffiti art or
sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I guess that's where I've evolved to.
Yeah.
Right?
And
it's not so much. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, just to use television as an example, I mean, a lot of people, until very recently, would brag about not owning a television and thinking that made them somewhat superior. But, I mean, we live in what a lot of people are calling the golden age of television or the platinum age of television, where there's magnificent art in, just from The Sopranos on up, if you will, that I don't think a lot of the criticism that television had, say, 10, 15, 25 years ago, applies today.
Yeah. No, I agree. So I think that's where, that's a never-ending, complex discussion, but I think in terms of where I'm evolving towards, it is towards more that position of finding excellence in all sorts of artistic places that I wouldn't have necessarily gone to, like maybe back in my sophomore snob days, in my sophomore snob days I just kind of blindly followed those who said that there was, for example, nothing of value to be gained by watching anything on television, that all the only things worth imbibing were things that had by that have, you know, been approved to be, you know, part of the Western canon, for example, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's a very, it's a very simplistic view. It's a very simplistic view that I've evolved past. So.
I want to go to the beginning of the book, because you dedicate the book to this part of the world in which you live, in which we all live, I guess.
Yeah.
This place really does infuse your work, doesn't it? I mean, we're all talking about how Vancouver is changing, and
I'm sure,
and then, you know, we're friends on Facebook, so I've seen your posts on this. I don't feel like I'm talking at a school. you've thought about other places that you've been, and I mean, you mentioned traveling to the East recently, how that makes you feel, and well, what keeps you in Vancouver?
You know, I often ask myself that. I mean, there are practical reasons why I'm in Vancouver. My family's here. My friends, my network is here. I've lived here my whole life, so... my professional network is mostly here, but other than that, it's a great place to create. You know, and I've said this a number of times to other people, and I think it's true. I mean, for me, anyways, it remains true. There's something about. There's something about the youth of Vancouver that is more conducive to me as an artist than, say, you know, living in an older city like Toronto or New York, where I feel like I would need to. I mean, if I were to move there and live there as a professional artist, I feel like I would need to fit myself into something that's already very well established. Whereas in Vancouver, I think there's more freedom to be what you want to be, right?
Yeah.
And to build new structures and to forge new visions, right? So, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love going to Toronto, to New York, and you know, whenever I go there, I always feel invigorated. But it's always, you know, whenever I return to Vancouver, I always feel like, you know, and often it's on the tail end of actually seriously considering moving. To, you know, to Toronto, for example. Usually Toronto would be the more viable choice for me, being Canadian, the situation, the political situation in the States right now.
Sure.
But, whenever I return to Vancouver, it's the place sings to me, the city sings to me like no other, and I feel like I can contribute more as an artist to the landscape here in Vancouver. Than I might be able to in Toronto. So, yeah.
You mentioned already, and you say this near the end of the book, that there's perhaps another book in terms of things that you want to talk about, things that you need to unpack, say. Having written this book, Double Melancholy, and having having it published now, do you find that you learned something about yourself that you didn't know before? And I ask that because throughout the book, and I mentioned this in the introduction, that there's a dialogue that you have with yourself throughout the book, in parentheses, criticizing yourself often very harshly. And I'm wondering, I mean, you can't have gone through the writing of a book like this and talk about such deeply personal things without having, say, gain some insight into who you are, and I'm wondering what that is.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I mean, I know that I have learned quite a bit about myself. I I'm not sure necessarily how well I can articulate it right now, because I'm still, you know, I'm still kind of inside it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I kind of, you know, like I barely finished the book, and then, you know, I had to do this tour, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm still so inside the process in many ways that I haven't had a chance to, like, kind of just sit back and reflect on what I've done. I think... What have I learned about myself?
Maybe I'll give you something that I was thinking about that you can confirm or perhaps.
What do you think I've learned about myself? Yeah.
I think you've learned, because you start the book by saying that this is a book about striving, about finding one's place in the society that we live in.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering at the end of it, because it does seem, and I started our interview today by asking, mm-hmm. by mentioning that you do appear like a snob at a young age.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, it seems that you've made peace with that you're a lot more empathetic with other people's art, say, than you once were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where that comes from. Is that from growing older, say, or is that life experience that probably teaches you that?
Yeah, there's no question that life experience has, you know, has taught me that people, you know, people experience pain, and that the way that hurtful things that people might do, I think, instead of reacting in a knee-jerk way to it, I think I'm much better at just kind of stepping back, taking a deep breath, and realizing, yeah, this person is a human being just like I am, who has gone through a certain amount of pain that is causing them to act this way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and so I think I'm much better at doing that now and depersonalizing the situation than I was in the past. Right. I think in the past, I would take any kind of hurtful statement or action made towards me I would just personalize it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm really learning to not do that anymore. You know, and I think that's part of, it's part of this process of unselfing that I'm kind of settling into, right? Which, it's the result of my Buddhist practice that I talk about in the book,
mm-hmm.
right? It's which is so antithetical to, or ostensibly antithetical to, how we're raised in the West, you know, which is very self-oriented,
right?
You know. And so the Buddhist practice is very much, it does go against the stream of that, you know. It's challenging. It's challenging. But if, for me anyways, just speaking for myself, I think embracing that and taking the time to embrace it, as challenging as it's been well worth it. It's been well worth the challenge. But I can honestly say that I am a more empathetic
mm-hmm.
person than I was. I think I'm less snobbish. I would say that I'm less snobbish
mm-hmm.
than I was when I was younger. Yeah. So.
It really is the book is such a fine achievement because this dialogue that you have with yourself obviously shows to the reader the evolution that you're going through even as you're writing the thing. If I'm like a lot of readers, it's given me a lot to think about. So I think, in that sense, I think a lot of people who read Double Melancholy will get so much out of it that they didn't expect, say. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but there's been so much to talk about.
And that's been great. I mean, your questions have been very probing, and I love those kinds of questions. So.
The book is called Double Melancholy, Art, Beauty, and the Making of a Brown Queer Man. Arsenal Pulp Press is its publisher, C.E. Gatchelian. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.